Africans at home and throughout the diaspora. Unity is strength. We've got the power.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
We need more unity. Come.
Stop the fussing and the fighting. Now the time to do the right thing.
In the spirit of Umoja.
Yes, this is Jamala Rogers, your host of Voices from the Battlefield, and this is the first Wednesday of the month, which means it's Black Commentator Roundtable time. So if you are doing lunch, tell your other lunch buddies to go to Jamala Rogers' live Facebook page and listen in. This is the time that I do remind you that we have a 34 count felon, a pathological liar, a twice impeached so-called president that's trying to lead us off the cliff and destroying a democracy on the way. So people around the world are watching and waiting, like, when are y'all gonna do something with that man? And so we are continually trying to think about ways to get him together and the MAGAites. So That's a challenge, y'all, but we all got a part to play in that. It's not just, you know, the woke people, you know, the other folks got to get woke too. It's not just Black people and brown people, it's all of us that are suffering. So so we're going to try to give you some insights today. Yeah, so today we have Bill Fletcher and we have David Love, and we won't have Reverend Irene Monroe because she is under a power outage in Boston, and so she could not join us. And so in Boston, they believe the power outage is due to the extreme heat, which means to us, y'all, for those who were non-believers, that global warming is real. Ask the people in Europe about that are, you know, trying to order fans online, you know, window fans that they never had to have. So yeah, so this is not good, y'all, because this is a kind of heat that I call killer heat. And not because that's a catchy phrase, because it actually does kill people. You don't come out of this unscathed, particularly those folks who don't have access to air conditioner, which is no longer a luxury, it's a necessity. So yeah, so that speaks to some of the environmental damage that's being done by these billionaires and their corporations. Us doing recycling in our homes, that ain't gonna get it, y'all. These folks are damaging in ways that we can't even imagine. So we have to be woke about that as well. So I'm gonna welcome to the show David and Bill, and we're gonna talk about what we've written since we last were together that we want people to zero in on. And so I know, David, you had a piece about your presentation to a youth conference, and I asked if you would like report on that. But I know that we also, you and I both did something about the 4th of July in the last issue of Black Commentator. And so pick whatever you want, you know, and Bill got a bunch of stuff he could choose from. So we're going to let David go first. That might be the easier one, to give Bill a chance to go through all his files of writings.
Okay. Well, pleasure to be with you. And also, Bill, pleasure to be with you once again. Just quickly, I'll just mention this youth conference that I participated in. I am not a youth, of course, but I think it's always important to engage with young people. So I'm a member on the board of this organization called Restorative Justice International. And it is dedicated to trying to bring about change in the world through restorative justice. Nonviolent means, you know, outside of the carceral state, trying to bring about a healing in the world. And the organization hosted a global conference of about 600 young people from across the various nations, discussing issues of restorative justice, including the criminal justice system, the death penalty, prisons, other issues. And I discussed the role of media in causing harm in the world in terms of human rights violations, in terms of genocide and other harm to marginalized groups. And, you know, I think it's an issue that people don't really discuss that often, because when we think of violence, we think about the policies, we think about the weapons, but we don't think about the media and how the newspapers, how the social media apps, radio, TV can actually bring about harm. So I looked at that and I talked about different ways that we need to build independent media and look towards journalism and the news media as a method, as a tool to actually bring about restorative justice and to actually center the poor, center marginalized people, and to make amends for all of the damage that has been done in the past and in the present. So that's a little bit of what I've been working on. And obviously, you know, we are coming towards July 4th, which I like to refer to as White Juneteenth. So I wrote an article, Time to Reexamine Frederick Douglass's What to the Slave is the 4th of July? And of course, I'm talking about the speech that he gave on July 5th, 1852, 76th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. And I think that some of the things that he said in that speech really speaks to how we as Black people should feel about the 4th of July and the United States in general. So he said, "This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days in the year, the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is the constant victim." And when you look at the history of this country, the history of Black people in this country, the fact that this nation was formed on genocide and enslavement, I personally believe that the 4th of July has little to nothing to do with us. We had nothing to celebrate. We are trying to get free to this very day. But at the same time, I do believe that African-Americans are at the heart of efforts to try to validate what the so-called founders said in terms of, you know, a more perfect union and all those things. So, you know, I don't celebrate it. By no means do I celebrate it. But I think that what we have to do, and we're constantly doing, is fighting to make all of these lofty goals a real thing.
What did you write in the last week or so, Bill, that we need to be paying attention to, that you'd like to uplift?
Less what I've written and more what some other people wrote yesterday. And that was the decision by the Supreme Court that upholds the 14th Amendment. And I just want to read this, because I've been looking at various things on social media with these maggots going just really nuts about the decision. And it's really interesting, because if you just read the Constitution, it says as follows: all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any persons of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, what's really amazing to me is that you couldn't be clearer than they are in the 14th Amendment. And by the way, when we're talking about celebrating revolutions, I celebrate the Civil War. That was the second revolution. And it aimed to accomplish what the first revolution could not. And that was the emancipation of African slaves. And it was obviously incomplete. But in yesterday's decision, it was just amazing when you had Clarence Thomas and Alito writing against it, a black man and a guy of Italian origin, and the arguments that Thomas made, it was frightening in the level of stupidity. You know, like when you look at the actual history of the rulings since the passage of the 14th Amendment, the courts have actually been very clear about this. There's not been any ambiguity. There was a very important case in 1898 that dealt with a Chinese person, and it said, it reaffirmed the 14th Amendment. Stephen Miller, the notorious fascist in the Trump administration, was ballistic yesterday, absolutely ballistic in attacking the court. And they're talking now about trying to do some sort of legislation. But it tells us that this, anyone that was unclear should be clear. The attack on the 14th Amendment was never about criminal, undocumented immigrants. It was about a redetermination of who could be in the United States. And without saying it, but linked to the kind of ethnic cleansing that has been underway in the name of what they call remigration, it was an effort at restoring the white republic to its status. That's what I wanted to throw in, Jamala.
So that's interesting, because that's one of the things we really want to unpack today, because when we look at the Supreme Court, and yesterday was the end of their session, so they threw a whole bunch of stuff out there. So it always seems like for every one thing they throw at us that we get, it's like three things that the Trumpites get, the MAGites get. And so even though it was yes to upholding the judgment for E. Jean Carroll against Trump, and for mail-in ballots, it was no to transgender students who want to be athletes. It was giving Trump more power to fire government regulators. It was dismantling TPS, particularly for Syrians and Haitians. And, you know, it's like, what is going on? And even though the 14th Amendment, they struck down the executive order, and people seem to think that was the big victory. But when you see the margin of the justices around the upholding of the 14th Amendment itself, like 5-4, I think that's causing a lot of the constitutional experts to go bonkers, because as you said, it's pretty cut and dry. So why isn't it 9-0 instead of 5-4? And so I think people have every right to begin talking about how do we move the court to being a nonpartisan body that is grounded in law and facts. And so I'm, you know, for us, what needs to be done, whether it's legislatively, whatever, because if we're going to continue this path, and somebody said that means we are one vote away from striking down the 14th Amendment, which definitely impacts people of color, particularly black folks. Where do we go with this? And I'm gonna tell you, as soon as the senator from Missouri heard about that they left an opening because it wasn't unanimous, his thing is, I'm going to introduce legislation that completely knocks the 14th Amendment out of the box. So they're already gathering the wagons to come back at that. So before they do that, what can citizens do? What can the legislators who got some backbone do to bring this thing to, or derail it and rerail it, whatever? What do we need to do?
So just a few things. So the decision on trans women was not a decision against trans girls participating in sports. It was a decision about who participates in what sports.
Right, and what gender, yeah.
Yes, and we could go into that at some point. It's a longer discussion and very controversial. The decision was 6-3, and it was, there was this, one of the justices agreed in part and disagreed in part, but did not side with the opposition. The fact that you had three that voted against it is purely ideological. It's not It has nothing to do with judicial interpretation. It's ideological, and it is in support both of this thing that's called a unitary executive, that basically the president can do whatever the president wants to do. But it also is about ethnic cleansing, which I believe that Clarence Thomas, among others, wants to do. That Clarence Thomas's politics are not all that different from some of the right-wing Black nationalists who are anti-immigrant but call for reparations for the descendants of slaves. So we as African Americans need to be very clear about this, and we need to openly discuss that. The second thing is that I don't think that there's any basis to believe that any legislation could change this because it's the Constitution. What would need to happen would be an amendment to the Constitution. Now, what that means is that for people like us, we should be doing what we should have been doing for a long time, which is doing broader political education and building a counter move to any efforts to change the Constitution. Because they'd have to pass something in Congress, and then state after state would have to vote on such an amendment. So they might be able to pass something, but I think it's probably unlikely. The deeper problem is that this, in my humble opinion, this will not be resolved by expanding the court. Because the problem is, and I was thinking about this when I was listening to Senator Markey earlier today talk about it, is that it doesn't do any good if we got neo-fascists as presidents, right? You could expand the court, by another four people. Who is going to be appointed? And that's always the problem when you start talking about expanding the court. Everything will depend on who the president is and what the balance of forces is in Congress, which to me means that the fight goes back to a fight around political power and a fight to change the balance in Congress and in state legislatures.
Wow, I know, David, you've been thinking about this. What are your thoughts? Do you pretty much agree with Bill?
Yeah, Bill makes some excellent points. I would also add that I think that there's so many reforms that need to be enacted. It's not just one thing here or one thing there. I would say that one of the larger issues is that this court is thoroughly corrupt, and we have to take money out of politics, and we have to take money out of the process of selecting Supreme Court justices. And also, we have to, I believe, limit the power of the courts to decide certain things, such as, fundamental civil rights of people. I mean, when you look at the power that this court has, other high courts in other countries, it doesn't work like this. And the fact that, we're always on the edge of our seats waiting to see if a judge is going to retire, or, if one dies, then we think that, democracy hangs in the balance, as if we ever had democracy. But we have to do something about that. I believe that this issue of political power is important. And ultimately, and this obviously is not going to happen tomorrow, but we have to reimagine, rethink, redesign our system of governance. And obviously that's a long-term proposition, but we can't keep coming back to this thing where, oh, they're eviscerating trans rights, they're eviscerating Black folks' rights. We can't keep doing this. And yet, this is very much how the Supreme Court has been for the majority of its existence. So then is that.
Yeah, I'm also thinking that, I forgot to mention the lifting of spending limits for elections, because now that we got all these billionaires, they can easily throw their own money and swing an election, which I think goes back to your point, Bill, about we need some massive education programs so that people understand what's happening and what their role is, because we seem to be getting swept away in these narratives, these false narratives, and in who we like and who we don't like, as opposed to looking at what they've done or what they want to do. And so it brings me to what's going on with the Democrats. We're talking about elections, because I think elections have both consequences and rewards. And so if we want to make that time between having an impact on the court shorter, then we have to decide who we want to lead this country, who we want to lead the state house, who we want to lead our cities. And we've fallen back on that, and we need to get back into the saddle. And it seems like Mayor Mamdani is going to lead the charge here. So now what we have, he did a sweep of candidates in New York City, in the Colorado election yesterday in the primaries, another DSA candidate kicked an incumbent's butt out. And so we are seeing not just incumbents, Democratic incumbents being put out, but some of them, you know, had some seniority and status. So Al Green in Texas is gone. My brother in New York that headed up the Hispanic caucus that had been there a while, Espelot, you know, so there is a shakeup for sure. And I'm wondering if the Democrats, particularly the elite Democrats, have not been reading the tea leaves, because for a long time we've been talking about how they have not been paying attention to the base. They have not been paying attention to the sort of political education that needs to go down in between elections. And now they seem to have no strategy, always reacting. By the time they react, the Republicans will go all the way down, you know, that train has left the station, and we are just in a mess. And so, you know, what do you all think needs to happen with the Democrats? Is it just strategy? Is it what's going on? And how can we at a local level have some impact on the direction of the Democratic Party, those of us who have the energy to do that? Because it seems like there needs to be some reinvention here at this juncture. Yeah. I mean, you cannot keep doing the same thing and think you're going to get some different outcome.
Well, there's a couple of things that I would throw in. So first, going back for a second, Montana and I believe Hawaii just passed legislation that restricts, that sets definitions in terms of companies able to participate in elections. We need a national constitutional amendment. It's the only way it's going to happen, to take money out of politics, out of electoral politics. So I would say, in part, Jamala, going back to your earlier question, if people really want to rock and roll, we need to have efforts in every state towards a constitutional amendment to remove money from politics. And that would be explosive. And it actually is something that I think could cross a lot of boundaries, much like the that ballot initiative in Florida that re-enfranchised formerly incarcerated people, crossed partisan boundaries.
Right.
So that's one thing I would say. I think that the second thing is that there is a struggle that is going on in the Democratic Party. The question is more whether everyone is going to actually get engaged in that, or whether they're going to sit back and throw rocks. So the struggle in the Democratic Party that you see in state after state takes different forms. There's the operations of the Working Families Party. You have the Justice Democrats. You have certain DSA chapters, right, that have been very engaged in this battle. And I would say in many ways are the ideological or political legacy of the Rainbow Coalition and what the Rainbow Coalition was supposed to be. So I think we see that happening. Now, at the level of the Democratic Party establishment, I often think of it as analogous to the French General Staff in 1940. When the Germans invaded, they had a question of whether they were going to fight the Germans. Because the problem for them was that while they may have hated the Germans, they feared the French working class. And in the United States today, I would say that the Democratic Party establishment does sincerely hate the neo-fascists, but they fear us. And they're not sure just like the French general staff wasn't sure what the risk would be in aligning themselves, in our case, with the Democratic Party establishment, aligning itself with us, right? So you get the James Carville line that you both probably heard, where he says that the Democrats shouldn't say anything. They should just let the Republicans crumble because they are so mucking things up that we just let them do it.
Yeah, self-destruct.
Right, which is a very humorous point of view. And politically, it is completely out to lunch. But that seems to be a very important line within the Democratic Party establishment. The other line, which is broader, and you see it in organized labor, is we have to have a massive turnout in November. And that's what's going to change everything. And while I agree, we absolutely need a massive turnout, in part because of what we should expect MAGA is going to try to do, it's not enough.
So I'm thinking though, in states like Texas, South Carolina, Minnesota, for the first time, is this is historic, the Democrats are running something in every legislative race. So David, is that an answer to their problem of impotence? Like if because they have like left a lot of seats on the table in the past where they put nobody up. Or they didn't invest monies in people who had a really good chance of winning and they lost because of that. So is that a step in the right direction?
Well, I think that for very long, the Democratic Party relied on these white strategists who don't know jack about anything in particular. And they've had this idea that you could just focus on a handful of states, and that was the pathway to victory. But yeah, I believe a 50-state strategy is necessary, but that doesn't mean much if you don't believe in anything in particular. I should actually amend that because I think the Democrats do believe in something. They believe in capitalism. And they're in a quandary because on the one hand, they require massive donations from tech bros, from AIPAC, from all of these special interests, and yet they depend on the votes of black and brown people. There's a disconnect. So Democratic Party does not stand for working people. And now it seems that there's a comeuppance, or at least there is a moment of truth where I think Democrats have been for very long in denial and perhaps not paying attention. But what we're seeing with these races, these recent victories, I think it's wonderful. I think we need to see more of it. But I think it's proof that the establishment wing of the party, which is, controlling everything right now, they're going to have to move aside. I don't know if they're willing to do that. I have no vested interest in the Democratic Party, even though, I have, worked with Democrats, for Democrats, and have voted Democrat. I care more about the liberation of the people and whatever we can do to get that. I'm with that. But the Democrats are going to have to decide now. I think they're going to have to decide how much they care about the money. And I don't think it's going to be difficult, I think, for them to part ways with that money, but we'll see.
Well, you made me think about when you said that they have these white consultants and strategists who don't know Jack. And that certainly was the case in Missouri, which was purple for a minute. I mean, we were on the cusp of like, doing some really democratic things. And then they decided that they were not going to invest. And even though this was at one point a bellwether state, now, I mean, it's really a flyover state because they made it like that. And so therefore, we got a Josh Hawley, we got a Schmidt, all these right wingers, when that was not the sentiment of people like 10, 12 years ago. And so, we just saw it unfold in front of our very eyes, what happens when you listen to the white strategists who have no knowledge of the conditions on the ground, nor the forces on the ground, nor the temperature of the people on the ground, and this is what we have. So we fight in the trifecta on the state level, and it just made our organizing very, very hard. So I just think that in terms of reinventing the Democratic Party, they need to be listening to the new and fresh blood, whether it be, you know, Democratic Socialist candidates or anybody. And they've been resistant to that. So anytime you're resistant to new ideas and fresh blood, you're gonna become stagnant. And this whole trying to make socialism the boogeyman of today, that ain't gonna work with these young people. They're not scared of socialism. And so you try to dangle that up like Trump has been doing, oh, now the country's gonna be socialist. You know, for a lot of us, that's not a bad idea. But at the same time, what the DSA candidates are doing still needs to be in the context of what are we trying to rebuild in the Democratic Party? How is it reinventing itself? Because they could just be marginalized inside there and not really do anything. Now, it seems like Manami has a strategy for New York. I don't know if he has one for the country, but maybe that's where we should be looking. Unless folks got something else, I'm gonna move us to the conversation around the war, because I think because of who we have in power and who is more interested in making money, using, I mean, Trump really has used the White House like he would his own business. He's just making deals. I mean, they came out yesterday with how much money he made on you know, the crypto stuff, and he's just making money hand over fist. And we are struggling at, you know, to put food on the table, to fill up our gas tanks. And so we are watching and trying to figure out what's our next step. But I'm looking at Iran as a really good example of the failures of bourgeois democracy and bourgeois politics. And I'm thinking these folks went into a war with no strategy. And, you know, when I look at who they're negotiating with on the other side, you know, I'm seeing somebody like the foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, and their military spokesperson, Zoghari. These people are very astute. I mean, the military guy's got like degrees in math. He's got a PhD in Western civilization. He speaks four languages. And people know me. I'm not all about the alphabets behind your name. That doesn't mean a damn thing to me unless you're doing something with it. But when you send a Steve Wyckoff and a Jared Kushner to negotiate with this level of expertise in the international, then, you know, what can we get but what we got? And that is, we can no longer say we won the war. We can't even say we have an advantage. These people are making the Trump administration look like fools. Your thoughts?
When you have the mind and emotional status of a 15-year-old encased in the body of an 80-year-old.
I wouldn't even do a 15-year-old like that. I know some 15-year-olds that would run circles around that fool.
I think that that's true. you get what you get. I mean, the narcissism, the lying, all of that. But then on top of that, you have his absolute demands for loyalty over competence. And then you add one more thing that's very specific to the attack on Iran, and it has to do with military theory. Ever since World War II, there's been this struggle over the question of air power and the extent to which air power can replace on-the-ground warfare. It goes back to Curtis LeMay, General Curtis LeMay, in the end of World War II and the bombing of Japan. It goes back to the summation of the of what really ended World War II, whether was it the atomic bombs or was it the Soviet invasion of Manchuria and entry into the war. And so part of what we're seeing is an extension of that debate, that their assumption that a massive display of air power would be all that's necessary. And then on top of all of this, Jamala and Dave, I'd say what I find fascinating is that Trump really doesn't care. He gets bored very quickly. When things don't quite work out his way, he's ready to disengage. And he has no one around him that is capable of shaking him up and basically saying, you know, Mr. President, we have to really rethink this. So you got all of that. Then you have within the Republican Party a consolidation around right-wing authoritarianism and a fear level within the Republican Party that to challenge Trump will mean that you'll be challenged in the primaries. And that's not imaginary. We saw what just happened,
Yep.
right? And so what I think that that should tell people is that Trump represents about 30% of the population. And this 30% is an historic percentage. And it's, I don't mean historic high. I mean, it's a long-lasting percentage in electoral politics that around 30% are hardcore right-wing, fascists and fascist-like. And so he's able to win in these Republican primaries, his people, because they chased much of the so-called liberal wing of the Republican Party away.
Yeah.
So the people that are in office now, the Republicans in Congress, even if they disagree with this guy, they're afraid. They're afraid of what's going to happen, which is why they need to all be swept aside,
Yeah.
you know?
I think some of them are afraid, Bill, but I think also some of them said, let this fool do whatever, so we can also be doing unethical stuff. So they raise, you know, getting money and gifts and all of that, because all the attention is over here. So, you know, it's like,
Yeah.
what part of this are they going to wake up to, except for midterm elections, or ultimately, who knows what's going to happen in 4 years if he decides he wants to dismantle the Constitution and run again? Who can stop him? So, you know, I'm thinking for people who are trying to understand how the way the attack on Iran affects us more than just the pocketbook. David, what do you say to those people in terms of national defense? What, past the bread and butter issues, what should people in this country be thinking about when it comes to a war like the attack on Iran?
Well, there's so many things. I mean, for one, I think about how the US needs to stay out of folks' business. I mean, first of all, you know, when you go back to the 1950s when the CIA and the British overthrew Mossadegh, the democratically elected leader of Iran, and installed the puppet Shah, you know, that caused a lot of problems, which lead us to, you know, our discussion today. You know, when I look at what's happening with Iran, on the one hand, there's this issue of Trump and incompetent being the only U.S. president who took the bait. You know, for years, Netanyahu's been trying to get a U.S. president to engage in this foolishness. Also, when you consider, you know, was we, you know, you, we were talking about incompetence and authoritarian rulers, dictators, they need incompetent sycophants. And when you look at the army, of course, we have, you know, Exhibit One, Pete Hegseth, they are eliminating all of the black folks and women from the leadership. Now, you know, military is not my thing, but I will say, you know, the fact that they are eliminating their best and brightest, that has an impact because you don't have a diversity of voices there to say, hey, y'all shouldn't be doing this. This is bad. You know, you don't have people around to provide counsel and guidance. And also what you were saying about the people who are, you know, the real estate dealers who are engaged in these talks with Iran, you know, it just goes back to this notion that you know, mediocre white men have this confidence, and they go about the world thinking that they know everything, and now we see the results of it. And you know, I want this for them because this is what they wanted. They wanted to be in control, but unfortunately, we're all paying the price for it. So, you know, this is obviously reverberating, in terms of the price of goods and services, the price of oil, so many things. But one thing that I will say is that Iran is emerging from this better off than beforehand. And I think, for Trump and his people, that's unintended consequences, but they're so incompetent that is what it is.
Yeah, so two things that you all make me think about. One is that we need to always remind people that when we are in these international conflicts and it causes folks to want to come to this country. So you got a bunch of interlocking issues here. So we have a foreign policy that messes up the economy, messes up the lives of people elsewhere, and then when they come here for refuge, particularly if they're black and brown, we don't want to give them that. And so I think it really is incumbent on us to give that little history that you just gave, that when we are messing up people's countries, whether it be militarily, financially, we first of all have a responsibility to check our government while they're doing that. But then when there's people fleeing, so reminding people that when folks come from Mexico, the reason that cartels are in place is because the demand for drugs, for getting high in this country is so great that we created that situation there. So when folks are fleeing from the violence, we should not be talking about you need to stay in your own country. Well, it's this country that created unbearable countries there. So that's the first thing. Same thing with Haiti. We have created, this country based on their policies, based on the multinationals that are there just extracting labor and resources. When those Haitians come here, then we should be giving them not just TPS, temporary status, we need to give them full status because they are seeking asylum from a country that is rogue based on the US. So my point is that we are creating not just unhealthy situations, but unsafe situations, and even in this country, national security issues. Because if you have a government that has eliminated the intelligence expertise, and I'm like you, David, I'm not all into the military, but I do understand intelligence. Like, if you got folks who are trying to get into your country to do havoc, then you need people who are like kind of watching that situation. Those people have just been like kicked to the curb. And so one of the things I read recently is that there could be now sleeper cells that are coming into this country based on the fact that we don't have folks watching that part of it. We over here in ballrooms and swampy wading pools. That's where the headset of the government. So these people are creeping in, doing things, it's getting situated. So in many ways, this president is a national security threat. And if we look at it like that, maybe we would be more proactive about needing to get his butt out of there. What do y'all think? I mean, this man is scary. He is scary.
He is, and yet he's gotten away with so much. I
So
think
much, too
because
much.
wealthy white men are always able to do so much damage. Although in his case, I think the damage is unprecedented. But the proof is right there before us. And if this isn't enough, I don't know what will be. But we've seen the damage for so many years. And I think much of his behavior has been normalized. I think that if we are to make things right after this, we have to make some changes to the system of governments so that this type of foolishness doesn't happen again.
So how do we protect ourselves, Bill, from
Well,
national threats, international threats?
let me put a pin in that for a second. See, I think one of the most important things politically for people to appreciate is that when we succeed in beating back MAGA, there's no room for a Obama-like presidency. I'm not saying, Obama is a great speaker, one of the best that we've had, but his strategy as president was completely problematic, beginning with the assumption that there was grounds for bipartisanship.
That it was goodwill on the other side of the aisle.
That's right.
And They hated
And I'm
that
talking
man.
about strategic bipartisanship. I don't mean like on this bill or that bill, but you know what I mean? But his orientation was, we're going to shame the Republicans into being adults. And that failed miserably and worsened the situation that we're in. So I would say that the beginning point is, no, this is a situation where you defeat them and you keep chasing them until they are politically annihilated, nonviolently, politically annihilated. That there's no room to talk about, oh, I'm sticking out my hand and we'll rebuild together and we've all made mistakes. No, there's certain mistakes that you can't recover from, and it's best to just go off to an island somewhere and just recognize that you so screwed up, there is no place for you anymore. And that's basically what needs to happen with these folks. And so, see, this is going to be something where we're going to have to be very clear, Jamala, because there will be people that will say, no, this is hard, this is cruel, you're being very cold. We've got to be very understanding. There's redemption. And look, I believe in redemption, but I also think that there's some people that can't be redeemed. So I think that politically we've really got to be there. I think that the thing you're pointing to, I don't want to be overly conspiratorial. I would say that I don't think that Trump would be in the least bit upset if there was a terrorist attack
No,
by,
no,
yeah.
he'd
I don't
welcome
think he would. Yeah. I think that that would be his Reichstag fire, and to be used regardless of who carried it out in order to crush us. And this is one reason that the anti-MAGA pro-democracy forces have to be very clear that our language and practice must be that of nonviolent opposition, while at the same time recognizing that we're going to have to figure out ways of defending ourselves depending on the nature of the attack. And but I think that we should not, we have to be very cautious, because there will be provocateurs within our ranks who will try to encourage certain kinds of activities that could be really destructive. So we've got to watch our words and our actions.
But Bill, there's people who think that nonviolence means passive. So you could
Right.
be assertive and aggressive and still be nonviolent. And so, to your point, I think that we have been saying, oh, let's not be the aggressor. Let's not do what they're doing. No, we need to be very clear on what we're doing and how we're doing it and why we are doing it. And it seems like people think any raising of the voice, any forward motion means that we're being overly aggressive. And I think that's an attitude that we need to depart with real quick, because these people got something for us.
Right. I mean, you just have to look at King. King wasn't passive, but there's a distinction between passive and nonviolent. And I mean, you know, there are those that are pacifists. I'm not one. But I understand that you don't go beating drums before you go hunting tigers. There's certain things you just have to be handled very carefully. And so nonviolent opposition, it can be a number of things that range from strikes to sit-ins to other forms of protests, boycotts. I mean, there's all kinds of active tactical approaches that can be taken to stand up against these nuts.
So, in the few minutes that we have left, David, what do you think our movement should be focused on right now between now and the midterms? And not the whole laundry list, because there's a whole bunch of things we need to be doing, but what are a couple of things that people can really engage in that's going to have an impact, that they will feel like they are part of the struggle for respecting and upholding this democracy or this experiment called a democracy?
Well, I think the struggle for voting rights is important when you look at what's going on in the South. I think people should really look towards that. I believe that we have to consider the nonviolent tactics that we've been discussing whether it's a national strike or something of that nature, boycotts, in the fashion of the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, things like that. Yeah, I think there are many things that we can do, those included. And also at the same time, as we're developing strategies and tactics for particular ends, I think we also have to start to think about what do we want on the other side of this? And I think we have to start thinking about the institutions that we want, starting to build those things. And yeah, basically prepare for the future that we want. Mutual aid and things like that. So many things that I think can be done.
One thing about this that relates to what you just said, Dave, is that there are discussions that have been growing about the need for a progressive platform, something that unites broad groups of, in fact, millions of people in saying, this is what we're fighting for, right? And it's not just what we're fighting against. It's what I call the second skin of the onion. The first skin is the anti-fascist consensus. The second skin needs to be about left progressive politics. And that's where we need a clear platform that says, this is what we're fighting for.
That reminds me of the I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Just wanted to mention that reminds what you just said reminds me of the 1972 Black National Convention. And I think that progressives in general, not just Black folks, but also Black folks, could really use some long-term strategy like that.
Stay tuned.
Stay tuned. And just want to thank my guest. This is Black Commentator Wednesday. And if you just joined us, we have had a hell of a conversation about some of the pressing issues facing this country, and particularly Black people. Want to thank David Love and Bill Fletcher for joining us today. And the piece that I wrote about 4th of July, it was because that's coming up, but also last week I had one of the descendants of the East St. Louis race massacre on, and we ended the show with playing the excerpt from, the 4th of July, which is always so powerful. And we're going to be commemorating that before the 4th of July. That's tomorrow in East St. Louis. And so I just really want people to just reflect on where we are in this country as descendants of slaves. And in my piece, I try to compare what we've gone through by looking at what happened to the indigenous people. At one point there was 90 million of them before Chris came with his dumb butt because he was lost. And now there's about, depending on what report you look at, probably like 5 to 9 million. So the genocide that happened, and the folks that are still on the reservations are plagued with drug abuse, alcoholism, suicide rates are high. There's the whole phenomenon of missing and murdered indigenous women. I mean, that does not need to be their reality or ours. But again, we got some examples of what people have gone through and what this government will do to you if we don't pay attention. And so I'd like to end with saying we lost some folks in the struggle. They are now ancestors. Bosman Red Deer left us, Dennis Levy, Ira Jones. And then on the national side, Toni Brown, who was with Black Journal, and First Lady Khadijah Muhammad. And so those voices and those heroes and sheroes, we are going to have to figure out how to replace them, because that's what we do in this movement. But if you want
Oftentimes
to
at home.
look at these previous shows, you can go to the YouTube. You can go to my website, jamalarogers.com. You can, yeah, there's a couple of ways to do that. So you won't miss anything, and you can go back even to this if you want to say something. And I always get to look at your comments afterwards because there's too much going on during the show. But we are always glad when you join us. This is Jamala Rogers, your host, and I will see you on the battlefield. Thank you for listening.